This has been I'm in the middle of a really pleasurable week here, and I normally live in New Jersey, and I love New Jersey. It's really nice, but I have to say, Santa Barbara is also really nice. And so I've been enjoying myself, and I've been enjoying myself with the microscopes and everything, but I've also been enjoying the opportunities to walk from one building to the next, or even out on the beach. So it's been a really, really wonderful time. But I'm going to talk to you about science tonight. As for someone who's interested in developmental biology, that is how it is that the fascinating idea or the truth that every one of us in this room started our existence, so to speak, as a single cell, fusion of an egg and a sperm, and that somehow through a complicated series of progressive gene activities and morphological transformations, we ended up looking like we do. And this is not just true of us, it's true of all multicellular organisms on this earth, that there's this fascinating process called development where you go from a single cell to something complex. And as a young student, that was what I wanted to understand. And I can remember looking at frog embryos in a petri dish in the lab, and just looking, and everybody else was gone, and they had to drag me away from the lab. It's really true. And just because the whole process is extraordinary, and it has to be understandable at some level. Over the past 30, 40 years, thinking back from the time when I was a student to me now, we've made remarkable progress in understanding this process of development. And we've made this in a wide variety of different organisms, largely though through a combination of genetic analyses, that is identifying genes and particular molecules that are involved in the process, and developing molecular tools that allowed us to see those gene products and begin to understand how they work. So in this whole talk will be about embryos from the fruit fly, Melanogaster. And one of the great moments of my education, because I started out thinking frog embryos were beautiful, was to actually see my first fly embryo and realizing that actually it's all embryos are extraordinary. So we're actually looking at fly embryos here. Among the things that we've learned in the past 30 years is that by knowing the genes and being able to observe the molecular products of those genes is that the spatial pattern of the embryo, where the head is, where the tail is actually, for many embryos, certainly true for fly embryos, is already implied or present in the egg that the mother makes before fertilization in a distribution of molecules. Now this distribution doesn't in any way look like the adult fly, but it's a spatial inhomogeneity that the embryo can build on to establish different cell populations. So in Drosophila, we know that there are maternally supplied proteins, transcription factors that govern the activity of other genes that are distributed in gradients along the anterior-posterior head to tail axis, or up and down here in cross sections, different proteins. And the embryo is basically like a little Cartesian coordinate system where a cell, someplace in the embryo, knows its address, knows where it is, and kind of what it should be by being able to read these maternal gradients and make cell choices. And the way that it makes cell choices is that these proteins here are what are called transcription factors. They bind to DNA and activate genes. They bind to the control regions of specific genes and activate those genes. So this this maternal protein called Bicoid will bind to the green gene and turn it on at high concentrations, and at lower concentrations of this gene, it'll turn on the red gene. It's called Kupel. And similarly, along this axis, there are a gene that we call dorsal will turn on some genes that define the fate of mesoderm, which is your future, the future cells that are going to be muscle. They're going to be made from this part of the embryo. So we know now quite a bit about how, what are the processes that control what we call cell fate, what it is that individual cells are going to be. And we also know how those cell fates come to be spatially organized. Why you have your head here reflects this initial distribution of information. So this is a fascinating story. It's one of the great advances in biology in the past 20 to 30 years. So we understand this about flies. We understand this about mini embryos. We don't understand it about humans or mammalian embryos at anywhere near the level that we understand it about these other organisms. And that's still an extremely exciting area of research. Even the molecular biology here is still very exciting. But I'm not going to talk about that. What I want to talk about is actually the next step. Because here, at the end of this point here, you can see that these cells are expressing these genes called twist and snail, and they know they're supposed to be mesoderm. They know they're supposed to be muscle. But they're sitting here on the outside of the embryo, and what has to happen is that once cell fates are assigned, the cells in the embryo have to move around and change their shape, and this simple shaped ball of cells has to transform into something morphologically different, into something that looks like, ultimately, a fly or looks like us. So it's that next step where the cells that are here, in response to the particular gene products that they express, change their shape and do different things, and now these cells, you can see, are buckling and moving into the interior of the embryo. So, in a way, what we're going to talk about is not so much gene activity anymore. We're going to try to talk about how gene activity is translated into the physical properties that govern mechanics, or govern movement, or govern a change in shape. Because ultimately, what we would like to understand in this talk is how morphology is established. We'd like to understand it the way that an engineer understands how you build a bridge. We'd like to understand it at that, how a self-building bridge would build itself. And that is essentially the mechanical question. Underlying it, of course, is always different gene activities. But I'm going to try to stay away from genes and proteins and try, and I think this is the goal of the field that I work in right now, is to somehow build on our knowledge of genes and proteins to get to mechanics. Okay. So you could say, cool question, but why do it on fruit fly embryos? And my personal answer is I think fruit fly embryos are really beautiful. Well, actually, I think every embryo is beautiful. What we're looking at here is the early stage of a fruit fly embryo. It's about 2 hours old. You can barely make out this palisade, this set of very tall cells at this stage. There are about 6,000 cells here in the embryo. Sits on a massive yolk. This is this little ball stage that we've looked at, and now all these cells know what they're going to do, and this is really the way a fruit fly embryo looks, what it looks like if you shine light through, just regular light through it. That's just transmitted light, and maybe what I can do is this is actually a movie. So, and what you see is movement. This is a time lapse, this is speeded up, this is about 20 minutes. We'll watch it again a couple of times. But you can't look at movement. Humans can't look at movement without thinking about force. And so you want to know how this happens. You can fold. You saw the fold go in? All right. So you can actually, nowadays, we can tag. We can look at individual cells by tagging the surface of cells with a green fluorescent protein, the GFP, and So now we watch individual cells, and you get a sense of the magnitude here. And now this is going to be this folds that we didn't see before, but here's that same kind of flowing movement, these cells moving up. Extraordinary things. You watch here, these cells are just going to divide. You can see cell division says there. I could actually watch these movies. I've seen the movies many times, and I could just continue to watch them, and every time I watch them, and it's remarkable, this fold that happens here always happens here. I mean, this is the same movie, so it's I mean, but if you look at other embryos, it's really true. There's a reproducibility to the morphology. So beyond the beauty, the reason you work with fruit flies is that there are extraordinarily powerful molecular and genetic tools that we have available to dissect the process, to identify the genes, to all work at that level. And this is really, I think we can still say, uniquely of all animals on this earth, uniquely possible in flies. So we have, due to the 100 years that people have worked in genetics and molecular biology in flies, we have, as scientists, this extraordinary background and this powerful set of tools, and it's uniquely possible. There's another reason, a medicinal advantage. There's something peculiar about flies, and the advantage is that the cells that we were just watching are newly formed, and they have no history. One of the problems always in understanding cause and effect is everything you look at has a history. And cells do something, and they could be influenced by things that happened before, and you don't really know when to begin looking. And if you want to understand them, well, what's special about fruit flies, and because fruit flies embryos develop so rapidly, is that they do a trick, which turns out to be technically to our advantage, and that after fertilization, what would normally happen in an embryo is that sperm and egg nucleus would fuse, and the DNA would replicate. The nucleus would go through mitosis, and then the cell would divide, and you'd have two cells, each of which had a nucleus. The DNA in the nucleus would replicate, the cells would, the nuclei would divide, and the cells would divide again, so you'd have four cells. That takes time. Fly embryos, because they want to develop really rapidly, figured out a trick in that they, after fertilization, the nucleus fuses, and the nuclei then go through a series of rapid replications, and the cell never divides. So it's one big cell with a lot of nuclei, because this means they can do it every 8 minutes. And after 2 hours, they've reached a stage where there are 6,000 nuclei in this one big cell. And then they stop, because they know they have enough. And then they say, OK, well, simultaneously, all you guys make cells. Pull down membrane between adjacent nuclei and make cells. Subdivide yourself into cells. That process takes about 50 minutes, but it does mean that after 3 hours, after fertilization, you've quickly gotten to a stage where you are a single layer of cells. They've just formed, they're sitting on yolk. The moment the cells have formed, and during that time when the cells are making membranes, they're also being told what they should, that's when they're beginning to express these genes that say what they should do. So the moment they finish making, subdividing themselves into cells, they start gastrulation. So they have no history, there's no previous, in a certain sense, no previous mechanics involved. And so that idea of having no history, and it's not a very deep idea, and it may not even be strictly true, but it was one of the ideas that drove me to thinking this would be a great thing to look at. The other thing is that, and these are scanning EMs now, and so is that the cell mechanics are extremely rapid and simple. And even though I showed you a time-lapse movie where things were speeded up, these two embryos are about 10 minutes apart. So you have you can see this ball of cells here. They all look the same. These cells know already that they're going to be mesoderm. And this embryo hit the fixative 10 minutes older than this one. And you can see this fold is already formed. And you can see it here in cross-section, this progression of the cell shape changes. And each of these panels is about 4 minutes apart. So It's simple. There's no growth. There's no increase in cells, number. There's nothing else going on. The cells aren't changing positions or moving around. And our belief at the time when we started this was that we could understand this. You know, if we could just understand what the cell, just have to look at focus the individual cells, what they do, and put it all together, and we could understand that. And so one of the themes of tonight's talk is the intellectual question of whether that's the right approach, whether you can understand a process like this by breaking it down into the behavior of individual cells and then putting them all together and understanding the process. Okay, so, and we can look at it. Now we're looking at the belly side. We're going to look at this fold form again. And if you look at any individual cell, we're focusing right on the surface of the embryo. You can see initially all the cells are pretty much the same shape, but if you follow any individual cell in this in the region where the fold is going to form, what you can see is the most obvious feature is the apex, that is the top of the cell. They become smaller and smaller. There's an apical constriction. The cells are initially rectangle, and they become very reduced in surface area at the top. Do you see that? That it reduces down to zero, and then the fold forms and the cell goes away. Okay. So we can look at the process like this, and we can say, we started it with cells that are square, and what's actually driving the process is that we squeeze here, the cell gets long, and then it shortens and goes inside. And so what you would have, how? Okay, so obviously to change shape you have force, you have to apply force to the cell. And we know about proteins that provide force. One of the most famous, obvious ones are muscles. Have actin and myosin, and those that remember the pictures are of muscle cells. Myosin is what's called a motor protein. It interacts with actin and fibers and walks effectively along the fibers, exerting a contractile force, which is how our muscles work. Cells have myosin, even if they're not organized into muscles, and can generate force. And so if you look now in cross-section, what we can see is that right before gastrulation, most of them, we're looking at myosin here. We're able to do that nowadays, which by labeling the protein. And the myosin is on the bottom of the cell. And what we see, these are the cells that are going to be mesoderm. What we see again over this 10-minute transition is that the myosin that was here kind of goes away and accumulates on the other side of the cell. So what we're doing is we're putting a contractile, we're moving a contractile motor from here to here. And intuitively, it's pretty obvious and simple that you can imagine that that's going to drive apical constriction and drive this cell shape change. Okay. So we can actually, this is happening in every little individual cell, that the myosin is changing its distribution, the cell changes its shape. So you could, one of the surprises, though, was that when we actually looked at the myosin in greater detail, now we're looking down on the surface of the cell, you could see the myosin, and we thought it would be like in little rings or little patches that would correspond to each cell, but instead, over these 800 cells, there was like an interconnected meshwork. It didn't correspond at all to the boundaries of the cells. It was like once this group of cells knew that they were going to be mesoderm, they changed their architecture in a way such that they were all interconnected with each other, and the internal actin and myosin fibers of one cell would kind of meet at the surface with the next cell, and you had a meshwork. And it was that meshwork that was contractile. There was another feature of that meshwork that turned out to be really helpful, informative. We can actually see that meshwork forming here. The myosin's in green now, and you can see the outlines of the cells, and you can see this. You can follow it in an individual cell. Actually, the next slide is better. Look up here. You start with a cell, And you can see in that cell that this myosin network is forming, but it's accumulating and going away and accumulating and going away. Look, accumulates and goes away. And each time it accumulates, the cell gets smaller. And it accumulates, so it's like myosin is accumulating and making the cell smaller and then smaller. So it's occurring in steps. If you look at all the cells, and we can film this, they're doing it all at different times. So this is a big 800-cell pulsing network of some contractile fibers that are each of those, which is individually kind of contracting, but with a periodicity of about every 90 seconds. And over that period of time, the cells constrict down. And this will turn out to be useful. So if we actually watch a cell, and we're now looking at an individual cell here through this process. Zero time, there was no myosin, and then you can see it accumulating here and then going away in the cell. And you can look at the cell, what happens. Remember, this is not like a ring of myosin, it's like a meshwork. So the myosin's coming out at different places on the surface, and that exerts force on the cell, distorts the surface of the cell. And then when myosin goes away, the cell relaxes back to a polygon, but it's smaller than it is here. So there's this ratcheting mechanism. And so that made us really happy. I mean, because we understood things. Except that actually we were really only looking at this part of the cell. And you can see the constriction here. This is apical reason where we can measure constriction pulses and everything. And this is the whole rest of the cell. And so what the theme of today, the talk is really going to be is it fair for us to think we understand what's going on? If we only understand what's going on here, when all the rest of the cell is, you know, the shape, everything about the shape has to be driven by, is the cell shape. We haven't really dealt with the cell shape. We've really only dealt with this little actin myosin up here. And so to address this question, we had to develop new microscopic techniques that allowed us in living cells to reconstruct, not just focus on the surface, but to rapidly focus through the whole embryo repeatedly to be able to reconstruct the shapes of the whole cell during the process. And this also was, then you have to also have software programs that allow you to deal with this data to reconstruct the cells, and then follow myosin accumulation, follow what happens in the cells. And what we really want to know is it, can we dare to think, even though myosin was the only force-producing motor that we knew and we could see, and it was here, could we begin to imagine that that was the only thing that was going on? How do we make an argument to show that this is the only thing that's going on? And so one of the things that obviously happens here, for example, you can see easily, is the cell gets longer. And so we would say, Matthias noticed, if you actually looked and plotted out what was happening with the shape of the cells, that, you know, it gets longer and longer. It actually becomes about 1.7 times as long as it was before. And so he showed me this data. This is a single cell. And said, see, the cell's getting longer. And then he said, see, it's getting longer in steps. And I said, well, Matthias is a physicist and I'm a biologist. I said, Matthias, this is the way all my lines look. This is, you know, this is not a... there is, you know, not, and so what Matthias did there is, what you can do though, so you have thousands of cells, is you can extract this data for each cell. You can take the derivative and you can identify the steps. You can filter and ask, if these steps in elongation are real, then if we compare, just do a cross-correlation between when the cell makes a step in elongation and when it accumulates myosin or constricts its apices. And on an individual cell basis, they're all doing it at different times. What you see is that before gastrulation begins, everything's bouncing around and there's no correlation. But your correlation coefficient gets up to about 0.6, which isn't great, which isn't absolute, and we're not so good at measuring stuff, but it's a strong enough correlation that it means whenever the cell elongates, the thing that it's constricting its apices. We can ask, is there lags? We can play around with this. There's zero lag. Cell constricts, and it gets longer. And so we've done that for everything that we can see going on in the cell, and every morphological change that we can measure is pulsed, and pulsed in synchrony with this accumulation of myosin. So we believe, by that simple correlation argument, that myosin is the driving force for everything that's going on. And how do we, so basically the question is, how do we have to understand how contracting here gives you the counts of the cell shape change? And the simple-minded idea in our mind, because we could also measure and show that volume is constant in these cells, is that the cell shape change in some way, mechanical way, has to be driven by apical constriction, a simple requirement to maintain constant volume of a non-compressible cytoplasm. So cytoplasm is non-compressible. Another version of this model is that cells are fluid-filled balloons, and you squeeze them at one end, and you get a cell shape change. But the crucial thing about that model that we realized, even though we liked it and believed it, was that the actual cell shape, in the simple version, what happens to the balloon is going to depend on the local elasticity of the cell surface everywhere. So you squeeze here, and what shape you get out is going to depend on where you can stretch, how stretchable different parts of the cell is. And so that maybe did drive us for a while to begin to try to make models with cells were like springs, and you'd squeeze here, and what do we have to put, what's the spring constants that we have to put here, and what do we have to put here, and how do we have to build computer models that will mimic the way the cells behave. And if I had more time, I would tell you about these things, these models. Some of them are valuable and insightful, and they provide you with. But I want to tell you that I'm not sure that this is the right way of thinking about it. And the way that this, one of the things that's changed our sense of the process, and in fact, because driven a little bit by the models, because you want to be able to get to measure stuff if you have models. And so what we decided we needed to do is to actually, rather than just looking, we had to be able to begin to measure physical properties of the cells. And are the cells elastic? Or is the cytoplasm viscous? How viscous? What do we want to, you know, how do we want to describe what's going on here? What do we need to do? We weren't sure how to go about doing that. And we tried a bunch of things. And the thing that worked out, right now, talking to me today, I'm really enthusiastic about. And I'll tell you, get it from me now, because 3 weeks from now, so what we can do, you can take and inject little tiny fluorescent beads into the embryo. And we can inject them in these stages when the embryo is still a syncytium, and the beads become incorporated into individual cells. And when you watch the beads, you put them in, they basically just stay where you put them. The cytoplasm is apparently very viscous. We've tried to use these bead experiments to measure the cytoplasm, and it is, if you took those experiments at face value, this is a cytoplasm as viscous as 95% glycerin. It is really, it's a very viscous cytoplasm. The beads stay where they are until the gastrulation process begins to occur. They stay in the cytoplasm where they are, and they act effectively as markers for the cytoplasm, and for the flow, if you will, or the displacement of the cytoplasm. So that's what we're going to use them for. We'll put the beads in, we're going to film these embryos and see where the beads go. So this is an embryo where we're actually colored the nuclei green because they are expressing a a nuclear protein in green, and we put a bunch of beads in, and, oh, okay, go. So beads jiggle around, and then gastrulation begins, and the beads get swept in to the furrow, just because the cells are going in the furrow. And we spent a certain amount of time focusing in on individual cells and trying to see how the bead moved in the cell when an individual cell constricted its apices. What Konstantin Dubrovinsky realized, though, in looking at these movies is that you could actually, rather than looking at individual cells, let's just look at the whole embryo and let's just look at all the beads at once and reconstruct the flow pattern of the beads. And so you can reconstruct the bead patterns, and you can, so this is the side of the embryo, you can see the flow patterns of individual beads. And then you can take those bead patterns, take many embryos and collapse also all the information along an axis. And by combining the data, we could develop velocity fields for the cytoplasm. And what you can see here, little arrows indicating what is the rate, what are the directionality and the rate of the movement of the cytoplasm. We can develop streamlines to describe the redistribution of the cytoplasm. And when we did this, it looked like in the whole embryo, the flows looked like a laminar flow of some viscous fluid. It's, you know, I'll explain a little bit more, but in a, you. And so what you can do, if you think that's the case, is that you can ask, can we take these flow patterns and can we predict them or fit them to the Stokes equations that would allow you to describe hydrodynamic flow? And the way that you do that is you choose some area where you think you've measured things appropriately, and you draw any little perimeter, and the way the Stokes equations work is if you have the velocities on the perimeter of any area here, you, if this is truly simply hydrodynamic flow, you should be able to reconstruct the velocities of all the points inside. And so this is what we're doing here. These are velocities. This is measured, and this is what we would predict. This is, you know, this is velocities in this direction, this is velocities in that direction. It's all predictable. You can superimpose the flow patterns. You can say how different are they, the same. They're about 10%. There's a 10% difference, which is really close to our measuring accuracy. So what we think is, look at these flow patterns. They are just, everything is, this is just viscous flow in this whole embryo. Now, that's cool, but it's vaguely disturbing because up to this point, we've been treating the whole embryo as though it was made up of all these cells. And we've been trying to think of cells as balloons that were being, their surfaces were being stretched and had elastic properties. And you cannot, over a long series of time, apply over the Stokes equations for viscous flow to something that is elastic. A different set of equations for that. And you also, Stokes equations are also based on this assumption that cytoplasm is continuous. And not made up of cells, or not made up of balloons that are, and yet we're getting a fit here. And so what that, all of that argued is we were thinking, and thinking about the embryo as made up of cells, we were probably thinking about it maybe the wrong way, or there's some conflict between this division in cells. And so we said, well, there are membranes there. You'd think that the membranes are going to retard the flow, they're going to have some impact, they're going to do something. And so what Bing He did was to, rather than inject beads in cytoplasmically, just inject them, he developed a way to stick beads onto the surface of the cells. The way that he did this was to actually stick the bead, inject the beads outside the embryo, coat them with something that was wheat germ or gluten, and which stuck to the cell membranes. And as the embryo cellularized, beads would become incorporated along the length of the cells. So then we can now have beads in the cells and beads on the surface, and we can say, it's being stuck to the surface. Does that change the behavior of the beads at all? And you get flow patterns again. And you can calculate velocities, and you can compare them to Stokes, and they fit just as well. And you can even compare the WGA-coated beads to the cytoplasmic beads, and the fit isn't quite so good. These are different experiments. We're trying to superimpose. And what we basically, it's still in the range of about 90%, only 10% deviation up at the surface. We're not sure whether this is artifact or that it's really telling us that there's something special about surfaces, but overall agreement. So what this is saying is that membranes and every the subdivisions of this are flowing with the cytoplasm. They're not like rubber bands that are or rubber surfaces of balloons that are exerting force. They are they're just passively. And that's ridiculous, if you believe in cells. And so, if that's true, though, and membranes are just totally passive, then you say, well, do you really need cells at all? Is subdivision of the embryo into discrete cells necessary? So, now we're going to get back to some genetics. Because what I didn't tell you about flies, but it's cool, is that remember we had this syncytial development, and then the embryo comes up to 6,000 nuclei in this single big cell, and then it stops dividing and begins to make membranes and does this new thing. Well, embryos get gene products from two different sources. When they start out development, the only thing they have is the stuff that's in the egg. And so all of early development depends on proteins and RNAs and gene products that the mother puts in the egg. But there's always a time in embryonic development where the embryo has to do something new, and then therefore has to rely on new gene products, has to transcribe new genes, make new RNAs and new proteins. And in flies, that moment is right here at this transition. Up to this point, the embryo has just been doing some repetitive cycle. The mother's supplied everything that it needs to do to go through that cycle, and the embryo is perfectly fine. At this point, it has to suddenly make membranes, do stuff new. It needs new gene products. Now, actually, the way the mother works is she puts everything that you need to make membranes in the egg as well, except for two gene products. And so the reason the embryo isn't making membranes here is missing those two things. And when it turns on those genes, then suddenly that's why you make membranes at that point. So these genes have the controlling property, not so much of being membrane, but somehow directing the synthesis of membrane into these subdivisions that subdivide the embryo. So we spent a certain amount of time, Thomas Laqui in 2002, and identified a gene called SLAM that affected this process. Bing Hay identified a gene called DUNC that also affects the process. If you look at either single mutant, they have phenotypes there. They're not so good at this process called cellularization, but the embryos make an attempt at it. The really interesting and valuable effect for this talk is when you make the double mutant, that is, you deprive the embryo of both these gene products. And we call that, a double mutant, needless to say, is slam dunk. And, yeah. You know, you work in a lab all the time, and you have to have, something to keep you going and little chokes, and most of what you do is cool and nice, but every once in a while you get to name a gene, and so, and you discover it, so you spend a certain amount of time speculating about what would be really cool. So anyway, in a normal embryo here, you can see they're making all these cell membranes. And in the slam dunk membrane, it actually still makes membrane. But it just can't, it's like little flocculent material everywhere, and little vesicle, and it's not organized in any way that partitions the embryo into individual cells. Now, this embryo is missing two genes, and it doesn't have cell membranes, but everything else is normal. It's one big cell with 6,000 nuclei, with the appropriate maternal gradients to make those nuclei different and express different genes in different places in that cell, but it's still one big cell. And so if you watch, so here's this in cross-section, in the wild-type embryo and in the slam dunk, you begin to express these mesodermal muscle genes here in this region of this, and so then you want to know what's going to happen. So I'll show you what's going to happen. I first have to remind you what wild-type embryos look like. I'm just going to show you a movie. Ah, good. A movie of a wild-type embryo. You can maybe see the nuclei here, and you can maybe, if your eyes are really good, you can make out the membrane moving down between adjacent nuclei here. And then the embryo will begin to gastrulate and do these wonderful things. We'll watch it one more time. This is not a manipulated, genetically manipulated, this is just how they look like when you look at them. They're nice. They do this for you. And there's some membrane going in, and then it's going to start to gastrulate, or ventral flow, and then does these things. Now, we can look at the mutant. So you're not going to see the line going down. You might see a little bit of junk, but it's going to start gastrulating. And this is amazing. Look at this. And it's this one. Please remember this in this imagination. That there, this is really, really. And it dies. So you need membrane. I mean, it's not good. We need to be cells. But what we really want to know is, in terms of mechanical force, you know, in distributions. This embryo is like cup half empty, cup half full, but it's doing it's doing things. It's, and the processes, these morphogenetic processes are, occur in the absence of cells or subdivision into cells. And so you can stain and look, and there's this mesoderm going in, and it's not as beautiful as wild type, it is amazing how much happens. So we can inject beads. We can look at the embryos, and what we know is that on the surface of these embryos, in the mesoderm, you still establish this myosin and that little area of the cell, this contractile myosin network, and it. Maybe this is a movie and it'll play. And it has the same periodicity and pulsing, and it will drive. Again, everything's a little bit messier and a little bit slower, but it's exerting force, dragging the membrane here. We can see that the membrane, if we look at the surface again, membrane gets wrinkled and pulled together here in the middle. And if we look at we can inject beads. And we can look at the flow patterns. And they're the same. So actually put beads in. And in the cytoplasm, they do this. If you stick them to the membrane, they do this. If there's no membrane, they do this. And so to produce this flow pattern, this morphogenetic move, you don't need cells. Now, you can do something else. So what we would like to propose then is that the way this thing happens is that it's essentially a laminar flow. And where the force is really only in the surface. And you imagine two little pots of cytoplasm here, and you contract this moving lid together, and you have shear forces that will produce flows. And this is the embryo. So in the cortex, you have this, and that produces the flow that you can see drawn, underlined here. Now, what we've done here is something slightly different. We said, well, we've always thought about cells, but if instead of thinking about cells, let's imagine, let's take this flow diagram, and let's draw imaginary cells on it. And because we have the velocity vectors, we can calculate how the cytoplasm in a block is going to redistribute. And just simply through flow, the cytoplasm changes its shape in the same way that a comparable block of that a cell would do as well. And we can do this, you know, more carefully or compare different stages. It's really quite remarkable how independent these processes that we've always seen and talked about as scientists as cell shape change is not shape, at least in the way that we normally think of it, as defined by the surface contours of a cell. These embryos, so they died. But even before they died, we can say there are other things that are wrong, that they can't do. And one of the things that they interestingly don't, they actually, what they can't do, is if we now look at nuclei. Remember, in wild type embryo, there's this process where they make this flow, and nuclei and cytoplasm are drawn in this direction. And then suddenly there's this shortening, the cells are long, and then it shortens. And that's that shortening that actually drives the final step of the invagination. And we know when we look at the movies that even before the embryo died, it should have shortened, it should have gone, and yet it can't. So it's sitting up there in this flow pattern, but it can't do the final step. So what we're beginning to try to think of is models where you need lateral membranes for the next step, but not the initial elongation. And so one of the models, and I'll just tell you this, and it comes out a little bit from the kind of vertex computational model, so, is that, and we can't put this together into a single coherent model. That's what also why I shouldn't really be talking, but that there are springs, and that during this flow process, there is a elongation, you store energy in elongated springs in the surface of these cells, and it's that elongated springs that somehow drive store the potential energy of the contraction and drive the second step of shortening. That makes sense, but it's not really compatible with the good fits to the Stokes equations that we have for flow. So we haven't been able to work out. And partially because there are probably more subtle ways of thinking about the process. And so I think that's actually the interesting point always in science, that you get to something where you learn something new and it doesn't seem fully compatible with something that you really wanted to believe before. And then you struggle. And we're definitely in that period where I think it's partially a problem of getting more data, and I'm a definitely go back in the lab person rather than think about anything. But it's definitely a point where there is a place for thinking seriously about how can we bring the different kinds of measurements that we're beginning to produce on embryos to understand the mechanics into some type of single coherent model. And that's the the goal, and part of why coming here is actually such a pleasure, because you, well, I won't say any more. So interesting is a novel. All right, so just want to make a couple of points. A great power in biology and great power in science in general, we know, is looking at things. And our minds are good at seeing stuff and intuiting. And the better you look, the more you see. And when you see things, that gives you new tools for understanding. If we didn't have the pulsing side networks, we wouldn't have had the tools for beginning to dissect. And physical principles can explain much. I believe this is still true, or explain maybe a bit strong a choice of word, and that biophysical and being able to measure things. Another, the biophysical properties of the cytoplasm, that flows, you know, the viscous properties and low Reynolds numbers are things that I have come to understand and be retaught by my physics colleagues. And that's also a great pleasure, but also most of these things you can understand intuitively. And lastly, I would never have thought, I now think differently about what cell membranes are doing than I would have before. Project was started in the lab by, the new version of it was by Adam Martin and Matthias Kaschuba, with two excellent undergraduates who did a lot of the computational work and helped us get into the computational field. Most recently, the experiments, the experiments that from the beads onward that I've talked about are done by two postdocs in the lab and a graduate student, Bing Hei, Oleg Polyakov, and Konstantin Dubovinsky. And I'll be happy to take any questions or anything, and thank you for your attention.
Right over here. So, I mean, on one hand, it's really extraordinary how much in the way of morphological changes can happen in the slam dunk double mutant. But on the other hand, the membrane itself, we know, can, through phospholipid changes, can change conformation. For example, just hydrolyzing PIP2 can open mechanically sensitive ion channels.
Right.
So we know there are conformational changes going on in the cell membrane. And I'm wondering, what's known about dynamic changes in lipid composition that contribute to the kind of morphological changes that you're interested in?
Very, very little.
Oh, public lecture question.
Yeah, so very little. I would say we have a single plasma membrane left in these embryos, and we don't know how that membrane and the lipid content is different from the new plasma membrane that's made that separates cells from each other. We don't. I think your question is almost more chemical than I'm comfortable with. More chemical than largely we don't know. My desire was to abstract away from all membrane into some abstract cartoon view of what membrane would be that would have some mechanical properties that we could think about, and not struggle with the chemistry or the content or the composition, even though that would, that's obviously interesting and also might be informative. But my hope was to kind of get above that. Above it, for just in the simple, not above it, but above it.
Wait, hang on. Good, turn the mic on.
What happens to the adherence junctions in the double mutant?
Okay, so,
translate the question.
Okay. What happens to adherence junctions in the mutant? Normally cells...
No, try again. What was the question?
That was the question. What happens to the adherence junctions in the double mutant?
What is the adherence junction?
All right, so exactly. So I was going to go under the translation of the question. So normally, cells, when you make them, they have their own little membrane around them, but they're held together by adhesive junctions, proteins that span the membrane of one cell and interact with the membrane of the next cell. And that holds all the cells together in a single coherent group of cells. And those junctions are, actually form right at the very beginning when the embryo is going to begin to subdivide into cells. So it, as it begins to make membrane, it actually immediately hooks those two, that fold that comes together, hooks it together. And that process is okay in the double mutant. So you, just as you're going to start making cells, you have the adherence junctions, and you therefore, and people will say that that structure gives you something to hang your myosin and actin on so you can exert force. And we see that, and that's actually what you saw. I didn't explain it to you, but one of the pictures that went by, that was adherence junctions and myosin. But what is, so what would normally happen is that you would go down and make this cell here, and this with membranes and everything, and that cell would also have little minor little adherence junctions that would hold it all to all this whole thing together. You don't have any of that stuff below the surface, but because you still have these little adherence junctions on top, you can, the myosin and actin can exert force on this surface membrane, drag it, you know, pull it together and drag the cytoplasm into a flow. Is that, let me ask two questions. Does that answer your question? And, you still have
You still need the membrane to keep the junctions there.
Oh, right. So you certainly always, this is not a goo with no membrane. This is this has the surface membrane of the egg, if you will. That's the membrane that's there. And that's where we're exerting force. Now, let me ask another question. Did the rest of you understand my translation? Kind of.
Eric, I have to ask the question everybody wants to know. If we can go back to the movie, can you show us the head, the tail, and the wings?
Yeah. It's some level of accuracy. Let me do it like this. And the easiest one is where I can show you the... okay. Let's go back to... was it this movie? This movie is better because we're on the surface. So we'll go here. And we have a bunch of cells. And remember this little fold that forms here? This is going to be the head. And this is going to be the rest of the body. So you'll see the head here. And the insects are segmented like us. And their thorax has three legs, so there are three thoracic segments, and each thoracic segment has, I identify with my animals, so, you know, three legs coming out, and then they have eight abdominal segments. In the embryo stage, each of those segments is about three cells wide. So in this area here, we're going to make thorax, the head, and then we're going to make thorax, and little groups of three cells that are going to be the segments out to about here. And then that stuff that you saw going is like the mesoderm and the endoderm go inside and make muscles and internal stuff. Mm-hmm. So when we watch the movie, so right here, somewhere right, there we go. Right, that's the head. And now we can count 3, 3, 3. And the legs are going to be formed from some part of this thoracic segment. Somewhere, and we'll do it again. Was that helpful?
Yeah, I think.
Okay.
One more time.
Yeah, we'll do it again. All right, so again, head's going to be someplace here. So 1, 2, 3 is a stripe of cells that's going to make these three segments of the thorax, and the legs could be something like a little cluster of about 8 to 9 cells right about here. I mean, so I don't, I know that from a variety of things, but and none of us know that those cells there are going to be the legs. We have a good sense of the right about here, but we don't even know whether leg is a meaningful word for the embryo at this stage. Because one of the things that you want to know is, we say cells become determined to fates, what they're going to be, and each of those fates involves a decision that, they don't have brains, cells don't have brains, but the decision process is essentially the activation of a gene or not. So you can learn about the decision-making part by a sequence of on-off gene expressions that represent decisions, if you will. So we don't know at this early stage whether there is a state that we would call legness and a gene or a gene switch that would come on and say be leg. It's the definition, it's actually something we don't really fully understand yet, is what it means to be leg as opposed to wing. We know actually, interesting, we do know something. This was my PhD thesis work 35 years ago. I'll tell you what, I've never talked about this for many years, but what I did in my thesis was I figured out a way of labeling individual cells and then allowed the individual to grow, embryo to grow up, and looked in the adult. And because I labeled an individual cell, I want to say, well, where are the leg cells? Exactly. The question, where are the wing cells? And what I found at this early stage was if I labeled a single cell and let the fly grow up, that I would find progeny from that single cell in the leg and in the wing. So by definition, in answer to your question, if a single cell can give rise to both leg and wing, what that means is that you can't make a decision or a distinction between leg and wing yet. The cells have to divide, so the decision between leg and wing is something which is made at a later stage, has to be made at a later stage after these cells have divided and you have a couple more cells. Not that they necessarily need to divide, but we know that they don't make the decision until they divide because we know we have cells which give progeny. That's a very powerful technique, and it's one of the ones that drove a lot of the very early work in embryology. And I haven't talked about that for 30 years, so that's great. Okay, cool.
Great. Hang on a second.
Yes. This is a somewhat of a complicated way to present the problem, but one of the ideas here was a unification of physics and biology. Now, I know in biology, basically we're looking at, for a physical system to survive, it must be able to store and process and transfer information more and more efficiently. Concept behind maybe evolution. So if we're looking at a system as it evolves, we're looking at this system from going from point A to point B, so you know where it wants to get to. So if we're looking at this system, and maybe this is a way forward in the mechanics behind cellular dynamics, maybe can be approached from a mathematical perspective. If we know we're trying to go from point A to point B, we know that we're talking about an efficient process or becoming more important. Proficient.
Yeah.
Does that lend any kind of? Okay. What I'm trying to say is.
Does it help to look for the most to look at the process from a purely almost theoretical or standpoint? Say, what would be the most efficient way of getting from A to B?
Yeah, like in physics, they talk about the principle of least action.
Right.
So I guess the first question I would ask is this the most efficient way? Has anybody quantified that? From moving from point A to point B, since we know where we're trying to get to, has the cell in and of itself in this process of trying to store and process and transfer information, has it over billions of years come up with the most efficient format? If it is not the most efficient format, then maybe that's the first step in understanding not only the potential evolution of the system into the future, but the mechanical process involved at this point. In other words, the cell is in essence trying to understand the most efficient mechanical process by which to accomplish its goals.
So I haven't done that, and I'm not even sure quite how one would look at a process and decide that it's the most efficient or not. I can tell you what my reaction as a biologist is to that approach, which is I am often impressed at how accidental and therefore inefficient processes are in development, even though there's you would imagine an extraordinary natural selective, you know, force towards efficiency. My sense of biology is that it is in some way constrained so much by its history that the kinds of solutions and the way that it does things might not always be the most efficient. Now, I don't know how to actually measure that or think about that. And this is actually a good question of language and a part we could pursue a little bit further, but my expectation would be that an organism that is successful on this earth, on a changing earth, in a changing environment with different animals and different competitors, is constantly faced with problems and a need for solutions to make something faster, to make it slow. Fast isn't necessarily most efficient. Make a bigger egg. Make the egg smaller, add more nutrients or not. Little challenges. And it will solve those challenges, speaking anthropomorphically, by some random mutational change that happens to work and happens to give a slightly better, faster, somehow, version of the car. It's still, though, encrusted with its history and the situation that it had before. So it might be that despite, and largely, I think, because maybe evolutionary pressures don't exist over really, really long time frames. They exist over short, immediate time frames to solve this problem and that problem and that problem and then this other problem and then this problem there, that you may not ever really reach the most efficient process, because you're always being jerked around by